Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Gabe Buller talks with a business expert about how the faltering housing market is affecting downtown renewal. First, the Louisville-based National Center for Family Literacy released results of a five-year study last week about early childhood literacy. Emily Kirkpatrick is the vice president of NCFL and spoke with Stephanie Sanders about the study and what comes next.
Give me the basics of what this study was all about.
The National Center for Family Literacy, otherwise known as NCFL and headquartered in Louisville, directed the work of the National Early Literacy Panel, otherwise known as NELP. The NELP panel was comprised of the foremost researchers and experts in early literacy throughout the country, and we have worked with them for about 5 years, compiling and analyzing the very best studies on how children, very young children, gain the critical skills that are needed to eventually learn to read.
What do you mean when you say early literacy? How young are we talking about?
We're talking 0 to 5, and we're talking very basic skills, such as learning one by one letters of the alphabet, learning individual sounds and words, so actually spelling out cat letter by letter, looking at, you know, just recognition of numbers. It's the very, very early skills that then allow a child to become a reader at age 5 or 6.
Okay, so what sorts of new things are we looking at here?
We're looking at very interesting and exciting key findings that will allow teachers and early childhood program directors to give children the very best instruction so that they enter school ready to read. So some of the things that we found are that alphabet knowledge and rapid naming skills, rapid naming of letters, numbers, objects, etc., are foundational skills that children must have so that they can learn to read at the appropriate age.
So is this something, you had mentioned early childhood teachers, things like that. This is something parents can get on board with, though, too, right?
It's absolutely parents can and should get on board on, and that's really where NCFL sits on this study. We are already working to get the findings out to parents in the form of critical tips that are available on our website that help parents help their children through daily routines. In addition, we've received private funding from several investors, including the Dollar General Literacy Foundation, to help early childhood teachers have appropriate materials so that they can give the very best instruction to the young children under their care.
Can you give me an example of what some of those tips for parents are?
Sure. How to actually read with their children in a way that expands their vocabulary and expands their letter recognition so that it's not simply reading a story, but it's reading a story with great intentionality. So we help parents work through a series of books to give them examples on how to do it. And it's really a system of asking questions with children, for example, through a process known as dialogic reading. That's one example.
Okay, and then I guess, do you have any idea how many people are visiting your website for information like that, or is it something you guys kind of actively go out into communities and try to distribute and try to let people know is available?
It's something that we go and recruit individuals in communities, as well as experiencing a very high volume of traffic on our website. We have, in the last year, trained more than 450 individuals on the principles of this study from 31 states, and that's early childhood professionals alone. And, you know, we can extrapolate how many families have been reached from that, and that would reach into the tens of thousands. What NCFL has done from its headquarters office in Louisville is translate the findings from this exciting NELP panel as they have come out, and we have put them into our work. So we've been enriching what we know as an organization and our services to parents and early childhood providers for the past 4 years.
Sure. I guess if we could kind of zoom out a little bit, if you will. I'm thinking back to when I was very young, and I'm thinking, you know, my grandmother used to read to me a lot. before I was in school, but it was never, you know, we didn't have certain tools, we didn't have a certain way of reading and things like that. Can you talk about how some of these approaches have changed in the last 10 or 20 years?
The approaches have changed with an enhanced sense of intentionality. There's a great deal more science available, so we can actually give parents coaching on what they can do and how to make the early literacy and reading process interactive. It's really about the conversations and an oral language experience with children, and that's something that has just begun to be recognized. And parents and children are finding that they actually have more fun when they aren't simply looking at a book and only sticking to the words on the page, but when they're sharing an experience together and expanding on the story as a family unit.
Would you say that, because I would imagine there are still a number of families in the country who... I don't want to say don't care, but don't put as much emphasis on this and, think, well, when they get into kindergarten or when they get into first grade, that's when, you know, all this stuff can start. I mean, would you say now that, you know, children who start these things at 0 through 5 years, that they're getting an advantage? Or would you say it's becoming more and more imperative that those things start happening at 0 through 5?
It's becoming more and more imperative. It is absolutely true that literacy skills begin developing the moment a child is born. And the window between 0 and 5 years of age just reveals an incredible opportunity for children to gain literacy skills and be prepared to enter school ready to learn. And it's absolutely essential. But at the National Center for Family Literacy, we also emphasize that that process should be fun and engaging and not a laboratory setting. We want parents and think that it's very important for parents to be engaging their children in dialogue and in a way that really sparks an interest and a love of learning. I think that it's critically important, as with any study, to take the conclusions that we're releasing today and are now available on NCFL's website and turn them into practical tools for families, for communities, and for anyone that serves a child in a child care setting or in an educational setting. So it's really what we do with this research that changes something for a child that's most important to the National Center for Family Literacy.
And then what's the process for, I guess, for formulating what those practical tools will be?
That's a core strength of NCFLs, and we are making and have already made user-friendly materials for child care workers, for parents, things that they can do on a daily routine. So it's making tools and activities that are very digestible and things that can be done, frankly, for little or no money. One of the favorite things NCFL likes to promote is what to do at the grocery store to build literacy. As you're going through the aisle with a child, looking at different products and talking about the letter that it might start with or the color of the box, that type of a thing. So we're really turning this research into actionable practices that can be employed and enjoyed on a daily basis.
Okay, I see. So basically... You're taking this study now, which you kind of directed, but you're taking the results of it, and I mean, it's kind of your bread and butter to put it into things that people can use and put to use in their children's lives.
That's exactly right. Everything must be actionable and have meaning in a real life setting.
Learn more about the National Center for Family Literacy and ways you can help children set the proper foundation for literacy at our website, WFPL.org. America's so-called urban revival reached Louisville about 10 years ago, but after a year of recession and a collapse in the housing market, the revival has slowed down. Indiana University Southeast Finance Professor Eric Dufresne has been studying market trends. He spoke with Gabe Bullard about how the economy is affecting urban renewal.
What kind of trends have you noticed, at least in where people are living?
Well, you know, we can look at short-term and long-term. Short-term, the past several years, we have seen an increase in multifamily building permits. Typically, multi-family building permits or apartments, condominiums, and so forth. In fact, since 2 years ago, you know, when we look at the problems that we've observed in housing, if we look at multifamily permits in Jefferson County, multifamily permits are actually up from 2 years ago. They're down slightly from last year. Single-family permits, on the other hand, we've seen a very big drop. Single-family permits would represent single-family homes. So what that tells me is that the resurgence that we're seeing downtown and housing in particular, I think, is the probable cause of the stability and also the increase in multifamily permits. Now, you know, downtowns across the country have made a concerted effort to revitalize and to reinvest downtown. We saw this with public-private partnerships such as the Cordis Group here in downtown Louisville, and that was done to attract residents to downtown, and that's starting to happen. We're starting to see more people living downtown for various reasons, which I'm sure we can talk about. So.
What all could fall under a multifamily permit?
Well, a multifamily permit would include apartments, condominiums. Basically, I think the official definition of a multifamily permit is I've got the definition someplace, but it's if you have a unit adjacent and on top of one unit. Okay, that would classify as a multifamily. But generally, it's apartment complexes and condominiums, which downtown we have mostly condominiums, I guess, as well as apartment complexes. And so all that type of project falls under a multifamily project or multifamily permit.
And that's building or zoning permits?
That's a building permit. A building permit. That's compiled by the census on a monthly basis.
So by looking at those permits, if there's more coming in for multifamily than there are for single family, does that lead you to believe that people are leaving their single-family dwellings and going into the cities?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the source of the multifamily permits could be from several sources. One, you could be attracting people from the outside, okay? So you could be attracting, for example, professionals and residents from the outside that want to move to the region. One of the reasons why downtowns have invested in terms of the amenities and also residential is to attract professionals that like to live in a downtown area. So that's one possible source of the increased residential activity from the outside. The other is from the suburbs. Now, we don't have the data to verify whether or not it's actually coming from the outside. What we do know is that the population of Jefferson County or the population of Louisville is actually lagging our peer cities. So we're not seeing significant increases in the population growth. And so that would suggest that the growth of the multifamily permits, particularly the multifamily activity downtown, is likely coming from the suburbs. But again, that's the deduction. I can't verify that with hard data because it's just not available. At least I don't have access to that. But I think you could surmise that it's coming probably from the suburbs because we're not seeing a significant increase in population of Jefferson County.
If that's the case, what would be moving people from the suburbs into downtowns?
Well, you have different factors causing that. One is simply demographics. Okay, we have an aging population. The growing segment of the population is 45 and higher. These folks, perhaps when they purchased homes, had families, 3 or 4 children. They're now empty nesters, and they're wanting to downsize. Not just downsize to a smaller home, but downsize to a home that provides them the amenities and the lifestyle that they want to live. And so many residential units in downtown areas in particular have their interest. Okay, so one thing is on the demographic side. The other is simply the... Now, what was the question again? I've lost my train of thought.
What would be drawing them into downtown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the demographics, but also the amenities that are now being offered, the investments that cities have made. Here in Louisville, we can talk about Fort Street Live, the downtown riverfront, the arts, the entertainment. So these amenities are also attracting residents to downtown. The other is simple convenience. You know, many times it's commuters have to fight congestion to work downtown. And so rather than coming from the East End or the South End or Indiana, if they're working in downtown Louisville, they see it makes a lot more sense to simply live in downtown Louisville, particularly with the high gas prices that we saw back in the summer. In fact, that contributed to some short-term growth in residential development, high gas prices. We've seen gas prices come down now, but I think that's still in the back of people's minds that, you know, we may be paying $4 a gallon again at some point. And so they see it as a wise economic decision to live downtown because of the convenience and the lower transportation costs.
Are there other costs that are lower for living downtown?
That's a good question. You know, I suppose if you look at time as a cost, and if living downtown can reduce time, that in essence that's savings. But you bring up a very good question, because one of the challenges that I think downtown development will face is the cost of living downtown. Many of the new developments might be prohibitive from an economic standpoint, simply because the cost of a condo or the cost of a single unit is simply too high, maybe for the average family or even for the average retired person. So the cost of real estate, I think cities will have to look at a mix of living units that could be affordable to various social demographic groups. The other thing is on the retail side. You know, when people live downtown, they want to also be able to shop downtown. You know, they want to live downtown, not just live, but also shop and use the facilities downtown. One of the challenges I think that downtown areas face is on the retail side, retail offerings. I know that's something that we've seen in downtown Louisville. I think there was a local market recently closed, a little grocery supermarket that closed. And so I think that's some of the challenges that downtown areas face. There has to be a concerted effort to also invest in some of the retail development that will be essential to keep people downtown. Now, keep in mind that the retail, the leisure and hospitality establishments that are and that will locate downtown will not survive or thrive based on only downtown residents. These establishments, such as Fort Street Live, for example, cannot succeed solely on downtown residents. They've got to attract residents from the outside, from the suburbs. So what that means is, unless you have an increase in population or an increase in income, you only have so many retail dollars to go around. And so any new retail establishment downtown simply removes or transfer dollars from the suburbs to downtown. And we've seen that in Louisville. The past, I don't know, 5-6 years, Louisville Metro has actually lost about 5,000 retail jobs. Now, there are some efficiencies involved with that, but you only have so many retail dollars to go around. And especially now with consumers cutting back because of a loss of real estate wealth, a loss of wealth in their equity investments, I think you'll see fewer dollars available on the retail side.
That was Indiana University Southeast's Urich Dufrin talking with Gabe Bullard. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer learns more about a year-long celebration this week with the Louisville Visual Art Association. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders talks to Chef Tom Hickey about the Great American Chef Series at Sullivan University. First, the Louisville Visual Art Association kicks off a year-long celebration Tuesday at its home in the Water Tower on Zorn Avenue. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with the organization's executive director, Shannon Westerman.
100 years ago, what was the Louisville Visual Art Association and how did it come into being?
Originally, it was the Louisville Art Association. And basically, it was a group of citizens, artists and art patrons, who realized that Louisville was sort of a backwater town at that point. They decided that it was important to bring art to the community, and many of them had been to New York and lived in New York. The Belknaps and the Speeds were involved, and others, and they put together this nonprofit organization in 1909 to exhibit work from around the country and the world, because Louisville didn't have a museum. Prior to LVAA, there wasn't a Speed Museum at that point. That was in 1925, I believe. You know, there wasn't a U of L Height Art Institute. There wasn't art curriculum in the schools, in the public schools. So it was a very bold and visionary move in 1909.
And where was it located at that time?
It was located down in Old Louisville near U of L, where Speed is now. That was a little office. But what they used was the Louisville Free Public Library. The library was the exhibit space. It was chartered in February 1909. In June, they had their first exhibit. They were very ambitious. And 4,000 people showed up at this.
And what was the exhibit?
Some of the big names of the time. Maxfield Parrish, Frederick Remington, Charles Dana Gibson, Maxfield Parrish, and Mary Cassatt. To this day, they're famous artists.
Because LVAA now is different than it was then. How has the identity of the organization changed over time and the programs that it puts on?
Well, interestingly enough, Elizabeth, the identity has not really changed. The goal in the beginning is still the goal today, which is to nurture the creative culture of Louisville. And obviously, the tactics have been different through 100 years. It's evolved in many ways, but it is still the same. We feel like we are the threshold for visual art in Louisville. We still stick to that same mission, that we are a catalyst for participation and education in the visual arts. The heart and soul of it is really the same, which is amazing.
And what about the tactics and the programs? How have those changed over time, and what's been added to the mix?
Obviously, there have been splinter groups and handicraft groups and handicraft guilds in the 19-teens. And then the art lessons in school and academic curriculum in the 20s became more important. Art education has been woven throughout the fabric of this organization for 100 years in one way or the other. Whether it being, you know, with our children's free art class program we have now, adult art classes and workshops and master drawing classes, all different mediums. But education is the thread. Art education is the thread.
Talk about the children's free art classes, because that's been a very strong thread throughout the history.
Oh, for 85 years. 85 years ago, this group started working with the school system to develop a tuition-free art instruction program for visually talented youth. And today, that program enrolls over 750 kids in 5 Kentucky counties and 2 counties in Indiana. So throughout the year, literally thousands of Children's Free Art Class alumni have gone on to become artists and designers and engineers and jobs related to the creative arts. So it has very much influenced the visual arts scene here in Louisville.
What else does the organization do today in the community?
Another very important program that we sponsor is called Open Doors. The Open Doors program has been around for 20 years. Basically, through Open Doors, we provide an art experience to underserved communities that otherwise probably have little or no opportunity for expression, for creative expression, especially in today's economic environment and with the schools cutting back and social services being cut back and both parents working. It's very important that the kids also have time to just nurture their creative and visual side of their, you know, left brain or right brain. And the Open Doors program work with a project site, for instance, like Guardia Care, Youth Alive, the Center for Women and Families. We work with that organization, with their constituents, to develop an art project. We hire the art facilitator or art instructor, and we work with them to design it and execute it and implement it. And they do it together. So it's a little bit of art therapy. It's a little bit of social interaction. It helps build self-esteem. It is a wonderful opportunity for people to discover talents maybe they never knew or existed and relieve stress, all of that. And the best part of it, Elizabeth, at the end of this project, maybe 8 weeks, let's say, that piece of art stays at their facility or wherever that organization and the artists who develop it want it to stay, whether it's a mural or a sculpture out of recycled cans that's over in Indiana at a homeless shelter that was one of our sites. It stays there. So it beautifies and reminds them every day of the power of art.
How is the Louisville Visual Art Association celebrating its centennial this year?
Well, we're celebrating the centennial through an energetic agenda of events, education, and outreach programs. And we will be kicking all of that off this Tuesday at 5:30 at the Water Tower. We will be also providing first-time programs that we've never done. For instance, we are going to provide what I'm calling a smart art date night for 20 and 30-something folks who really want to learn more about art but don't have the opportunity and combine it with a social experience as well. And we're going to provide a summer series of 6 different art classes for the public. And over the course of the summer, though, each class will take place in a given week. So it'll be a total of 6 weeks over the 3-month period. We also are having a paint out in May, which will be plein air artists who come to town from all over the country. And they will be on site in 3 or 4 different locations around the city. We're working with the city to determine where. So people can come watch the artist at work. And it will be a juried competition that will in turn be given awards and honors and blue ribbons, everything. We also will be sponsoring our exhibits, focusing on the children's free art classes. We have an annual exhibit every year where one piece of work from each student is selected. It's one of our most popular exhibits. Dinner Works, which is in its 22nd year, has this exhibit related to it, The Infinite Riches in a Little Room, which is Louisville artists. So you see here the theme of Louisville in every event or opportunity or outreach effort we have.
What do you see for the future of the organization?
I see a bright future for the organization, mainly because after 100 years, we have a solid, solid core of support within this community. We will always have our core programs, and we will be a much more focused organization because it's a tough, economic, challenging time for everyone. Also, to put our stake in the ground, if you will, for what the future is going to be in art. And we will always have our mission to engage artists and audiences in stimulating dialogue about our life and our culture and the issues of today. And visual art is a great medium to do that.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
There's more about the Louisville Visual Art Association at our website, wfpl.org. About once per quarter, Sullivan University's National Center for Hospitality Studies hosts a renowned American chef. This week, it's Chef Rick Tramonto. His restaurant, True, is in Chicago. His visit is part of the Great American Chef series at Sullivan. Stephanie Sanders talked with the director of the National Center for Hospitality Studies, Chef Tom Hickey, about that series and why it's important for his students.
So what is the Great American Chef series all about?
Well, the Great American Chef series, we inaugurated it here in October 1988, and it's a continuing education program designed to expose our students of the National Center for Hospitality Studies to the uniquely different styles and philosophies of nationally recognized chefs who are leading the American culinary movement in the United States. The wonderful thing about it is we're bringing in people from very diverse backgrounds in food service, and the great thing is our students hear from them some of the very same things that the instructors have just got done telling them.
So you like to have a little affirmation of your instruction.
Yeah. It's like, well, maybe I better pay attention.
So who will be coming to Louisville this year?
Well, this next week we have Chef Rick Tramonto from True Restaurant in Chicago coming in. And Rick is an up-and-coming celebrity chef, actually. He's done an excellent job with True in Chicago. It has some very cutting-edge cuisine that he's doing. And, you know, he's authored 2 or 3 books already. So,
I imagine you guys have quite a few chefs to invite to be part of this series. I mean, how do you decide which direction you want to go each year?
Well, you know, we try and cover all bases. The last distinguished guest chef we had was Chef Lee Conway, who lives over in St. Louis, Missouri. And Lee is has a PBS television series called The Camouflage Chef. And his forte was wild game cookery. So he came in and did a demonstration for our students and showed, you know, the various types of things you can do with wild game and plate presentations and flavor components and everything like that. Over the years, we've had just, numerous different people. We've had people from the catering background come in since we offer a associate degree in catering to show our students just where catering fits in to the food service world. We've had pastry chefs come in from throughout the United States, from casinos, from hotels, every aspect you can think of. An example, one chef I had about 2 years ago, Chef George McNeil, who at the time had the Marriott Marquis Hotel in New York City, is now the chef director for all of the Ritz-Carlton hotel chains.
So are you trying to catch people kind of at a kind of a sweet spot in their career where they're about to take off and become huge names?
Well, sometimes we catch them at the sweet spot, and sometimes they're already there.
Hmm.
And it's basically, you know, in the food service world, our world's relatively small. And it's through networking and various business meetings and conferences and things that, you know, we run across these individuals, and it's like, well, you'd be a very good fit to talk to our students and explain certain aspects of hospitality to them. And, you know, then we try and work with their schedules to bring them in and have them discuss their higher areas of expertise with our students.
Sure. Is it an annual thing, or do you guys sometimes get more than one in a year?
We try and do it every quarter. A quarter system rather than a semester system. So we try and have somebody four times a year come in.
And how do you find the students react? I would imagine it would be something where, and of course, I've never taken classes at Sullivan, but I would imagine from remembering my college days that you kind of get into the humdrum of, okay, I go to class, I learn this, and I go to sleep, and I go to class, and I learn this, and then somebody really inspiring comes in and kind of sets you on fire again. Is it like that for your students?
It's definitely. They get amazed. I mean, with Chef Conway, you know, the camouflage chef aspect of it, and having his own PBS series that really turned them on. They hadn't been exposed to very much wild game cookery. With Chef Rick Tremonto coming in next week, you know, they're all excited about that because he's going to do a book signing at the same time of one of his new books. And for a young culinarian, having a celebrity chef and having a cookbook signed and addressed to them is just like you or I, you know, having a very distinguished author sign a book for us. You know, it's a very personal thing that they treasure for the rest of their life, you know.
Do they ever, are they ever kind of elbowing you and saying, hey, why don't you get so-and-so to come? Are they giving you input on who they'd like to participate?
I get input from all over, from my students, from my faculty, from my various friends in the industry. You know, it's good because it keeps it diverse. It doesn't get humdrum where it's the same type of guy coming in each time, giving the same humdrum demonstrations. We try and keep it very diverse and very different in each aspect. You know, I'm looking right now for, hopefully in spring, I have to talk to the gentleman about it, but I have a chef owner, basically, from Michigan coming in that is up in Frankenmuth, Michigan. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Zander's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's the largest family-owned restaurant in the United States.
Wow.
And Frankenmuth, they basically own the whole town. And in the wintertime, it's a winter wonderland. Hmm. In the summer, it's German-themed, you know, tourism site, basically.
Very cool. So, I mean, I would imagine in that sort of case, they could get some business advice as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the good thing. These kids get a chance to ask questions, and they're getting it from the horse's mouth, basically. They're getting a real-world answer. We've had chefs come in, and they'll tell them, you know, if you're coming to interview me, you better look professional. Mm. And, you know, you better pay attention to your appearance. You better pay attention to how you speak and everything, because we deal with the public, and they want, you know, the image. If, you know, if I come out in the dining room to talk to you, and my jacket's dirty, and I need a shave, and my hair's unkept, well, you know, you're probably not going to come back to my restaurant. In fact, you're probably going to wonder about what you just may have consumed from my restaurant. So, you know, they drive it home to these kids and really tell them like it is.
Is that something you find with most of the chefs that you deal with, is that they're eager to, I guess, impart the knowledge and the experience that they have? They want to help the next generation of chefs?
They love coming in and talking to, as they say, their replacements in the industry.
Learn more about culinary studies at Sullivan University at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, I'll talk with the author of a new biography about Warren Buffett. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about the Louisville Zoo's birthday boy, a 50-year-old gorilla named Timmy. First, he's often called the Oracle of Omaha. Businessman, investor, and philanthropist Warren Buffett is one of the richest men in the world, whose counsel is sought by leaders in the private and public sectors. Buffett has never written a memoir, and until recently, not much was widely known about the 78-year-old's background and private life. That has changed with the publication of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, written by Alice Schroeder. I spoke with Schroeder about the best-selling biography and Warren Buffett. I'm curious about the title of your book, Snowball. What inspired that?
It comes from a saying of Warren's that life is like a snowball, and what he's talking about is the snowball effect, the way things get bigger over time, and in his case, of course, that was money, but also relationships with people and learning and wisdom.
How did you get interested in Mr. Buffett?
I worked on Wall Street as an insurance analyst following insurance stocks, and his company, Berkshire Hathaway, is heavily invested in insurance. So I got to know him because I picked up coverage on Berkshire Hathaway, and I was the only analyst who actually followed that stock. So we got to know each other over a five-year period. And I would go out to Omaha, I would meet with him, he would explain the business to me, and then we'd talk on the phone.
Now, did he cooperate with you for this book?
He did. The book came about because I got the idea that he should write this book, and I suggested it to him, and he kind of nudged me into volunteering because he didn't want to write it. And instead, he offered to cooperate with me, which meant that he did hundreds of hours of interviews. I spent months in Omaha. He opened up his files to me, and I interviewed 250 other people, his friends, his family, his business colleagues.
I guess most of us know that he's, of course, one of the wealthiest people in the country, in the world. What don't we know about him?
When you see him on television, he's got this sort of all-knowing and almost grandfatherly personality, but he is very different from that when you get to know him up close. And I really tried to bring to life in the book this other personality, which is he can be extremely cold and tough and at the same time very needy and vulnerable. He's very dependent on people psychologically, which is really different from what you'd expect.
Now, I have seen on television that he's quite an avid bridge player.
He is. He plays bridge four nights a week, five nights a week on the Internet.
So his family life, he's married?
He is married to his second wife, but he had a pretty unusual personal life. He, in effect, had two wives for a long time.
No, he did.
He did. His first wife, Susan, separated from him in 1977, moved to San Francisco, but they remained married, and she actually got one of her friends to move in with him, And the three of them had this very unusual relationship that lasted for decades.
Now, he also had a relationship with Catherine Graham.
He did. He and Catherine Graham were very dear friends, and probably more than friends. They were extremely close and had sort of an almost obsessive relationship with each other for from 1973 through the end of her life in 2001.
We're talking, of course, of Catherine Graham of Washington Post fame. Just how powerful is Mr. Buffett?
He's very powerful. Behind the scenes in Washington, he's very influential with both Republicans and Democrats. They call him for advice all the time. And in the business world, he is someone that, as one person put it, one CEO, everybody would love to have him on their board of directors.
I think so. He'll be a key player in the as the economic policies of the new administration are developed?
Yes. In official capacity, he's not going to play a role, but President Obama can pick up the phone, call him anytime, and Warren is great at thinking through what's going to happen next. If you adopt a policy, what are its consequences going to be? And he'll be very helpful.
Is he pleased with the book?
He has mixed feelings about the book. He's pretty ambivalent about it. It's very revealing, and while he was very open with me and he wanted a book that would be very revealing, once he read it, I think he was a little stunned at what he hath wrought. And so, you know, he really hasn't been comfortable since it came out.
I guess they see it in black and white. It kind of hits home, finally.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I mean, I have great empathy. I mean, parts of it were very painful for him to read. And at the same time, you know, it's the truth. It's an important American story. He's an incredibly important figure. And, you know, if you're going to tell the story, you really have to tell the whole story. You can't tell just part of it.
Now, did he come from a wealthy family?
He did not. His family was a family of grocers. They were, I would call them, sort of lower middle class, and then his father bootstrapped his way up as a stockbroker into the, you know, upper middle class, but they were not wealthy.
And he has, does he have children?
He has three children, two sons and a daughter. They're in their 50s. They are each successful but not wealthy in their own right. One son's a musician, one's a farmer. His daughter runs the family philanthropy.
What's been the public reaction to the book?
Well, it's been wonderful. It was a number one New York Times bestseller, and it's still on the bestseller list after more than 3 months. It was named by People Magazine and Time Magazine as one of the 10 best books of 2008. Amazon named it the best business book of 2008, and Janet Maslin, the New York Times reviewer, named it one of her 10 favorite books of 2008. It's been unbelievable.
The name of the book is The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, and we look forward to meeting you in Louisville.
I look forward to coming over.
Thanks for talking to us. Alice Schroeder will be in Louisville this week to discuss her biography of Warren Buffett. She'll appear at the Louisville Free Public Library as part of its Authors at the Library series Tuesday evening at 7. On Saturday, the Louisville Zoo will host a birthday party with an ice sculpture cake and piñata games. The special treats are for Timmy, a 50-year-old male silverback gorilla, who's also the oldest male gorilla in North America. Stephanie Sanders talked with Cynthia Cole, who's a keeper at the Gorilla Forest, about Timmy and his birthday party.
Tell me about the birthday boy.
Tell you about the birthday boy. He's a very special boy. He's a Western Lowland gorilla. And he is the silverback troop leader of a group of three females. And he is just a very laid-back guy. He's just a very bright spot here at Gorilla Forest.
And how does he interact with those females?
He interacts as the peacemaker if he needs to be. Sometimes the ladies will get in a spat and he will take care of any of the situations that arise, and he does it with usually it doesn't have to do much in order to calm everything down. He does his job well, and he also just interacts with the females, and they all you'll see them all kind of in a big gorilla pile in a corner, or everybody sitting in the same room, and they just enjoy each other's company as gorillas go.
And have they been in that sort of arrangement for several years? I guess how long has he been at the Louisville Zoo?
Tim has been with us since 2004.
Okay. So, and then I assume when he moved there in 2004 that he kind of was put into this situation with the females and introduced as such as being the leader of that group?
He originally came with one of the females that is still in his group named Packy, and then he also came with Tanuka, who passed away about the beginning of last year. But he came with two other females from the Bronx, and then he was introduced to Mia, and then to, most recently, Quaylee.
Okay, and I understand probably as a person who works as a keeper in Gorilla Forest, you probably got some cute stories about Tim and maybe like some of his preferences or what he likes to eat or things like that.
What he likes to eat is, actually, he's pretty straightforward kind of guy. He likes bananas, as strange and stereotypical as that may sound. He really does like those a whole lot.
He's traditional gorilla.
He is. He's a very traditional kind of fellow. he is. Some of the stories that I like to tell is when he first came, he actually likes blondes. He found a great favor amongst blondes, and I am a blonde, so he actually found a great deal of favor with me and would kind of purr at me, and it was just really neat to have a gorilla that seemed like he preferred a gentleman that preferred blondes. he likes to make people react. Being at the silverback, he's very, very protective of the females, and he actually becomes protective not only of the gorilla females, but he'll become protective of the people that work here also, the keepers and the staff that are here. And sometimes when he sees new people, he has a tendency to make his presence known by puffing up, running over, and dousing as much mulch as he can find to throw at folks that he doesn't recognize right off the bat. So he can sometimes make a tour exciting.
So you guys are throwing a 50th birthday party for this guy. I guess what does a gorilla birthday party look like?
This gorilla birthday party is going to be a pretty big deal. We actually are giving him an ice sculpture, and he's going to have an ice sculpture that's going to be brought in from the Gotthaus Hotel, and the suite's executive chef is going to be making a huge ice sculpture for us, and all the other gorillas are going to be able to celebrate by having pinata enrichment, which means that they're going to be given all kinds of fun stuff to tear up and throw around, which is what they love to do. And he is going to have a lot of people around to watch him, and it's going to be a good day for him. And I'm excited to see what he does with the ice sculpture.
That's ready to ask you. I mean, do gorillas like big chunks of ice?
Gorillas like pretty much anything that might have to do with food. They are very food motivated, and Tim is definitely one of them. The females in his group are probably going to get the biggest kick out of actually jumping on the ice and you know, doing stuff with it. But he will definitely enjoy the food that is put inside the ice. I'm sure that he will be able to get a couple pieces of that. But he'll just be, I'm sure he'll be hanging around looking at it thinking, what is that?
What have they brought me now?
Exactly.
So I guess one of the really fun things about this particular birthday party is that the public is invited to attend, right?
Absolutely. We want the public to attend. You know, Tim is the community's, and he's a very special member of it. And if they bring in an old cell phone for the zoo's recycling efforts, they will be able to get a discounted admission rate of $5 a person. So if they have an old cell phone that they would like to bring in, people can actually get a discounted rate if they come to the zoo. And they will be able to see the ice sculpture. They will be able to see the pinatas. This is all going to be done in our indoor exhibit, so they'll be able to walk inside and see the gorillas on the round and see everybody goofing off with paper everywhere. And
yeah, that was one thing I was going to mention that people should probably keep in mind is that it's not outside. You're not going to be going and standing outside for this birthday party.
No, we're very lucky here that we have the indoor exhibit, so they'll be able to come inside. So whatever the weather is outside, the party will go on.
All right, great. Well, Cynthia, thanks for your time, and tell Timmy we said happy birthday.
Thank you so much, and I will.
There's more information on the Louisville Zoo and Timmy's birthday party at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.